Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. Happy New Year to many of you that we haven't spoken to since the new year began, a mere 20 days ago. I hope that your new year has started out on a positive foot. We have a lot of information to share with you today, and I'm really excited about it. Most of it's positive, which is always a good way to start the year. So as I hope you all noticed at the beginning here, this meeting is now being recorded. And so just keep that in mind. If you make a statement, if your face is on the camera, et cetera, whatever name that you're using here to identify yourself. Again, this is being recorded, so we can't promise you any privacy whatsoever. As we lawyers would say, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy. So, okay, so let's go forward here. There's something new. There are new things that are happening on the AXL website. Some of them are kind of small changes. Some of them are larger changes, but I certainly wanted to call one to your attention, and that is, well, maybe two. One is that we have taken the photos off of articles with regard to on our website when somebody has been accused of committing a sex offense. And we did that because we realized that some people were uncomfortable with doing that. I have to admit, one of the reasons I thought it was a good idea was really who was being accused of violating the sex offender laws. And basically showing, it showed to me that these are not people who are already on the registry, but quite often family members, teachers, coaches, clergy, and yes, law enforcement too. So, that's a change on the way. And I think that, it's a positive change. We're going to try it out here and make sure, because again, folks, the whole reason the Alliance exists is to help you and to support you. And if you're feeling uncomfortable with something we are doing, please let us know, because guess what? It's most of the time easy to change. Here's another thing we've changed about the website, and we're going to change it here for our monthly meetings as well, is we beefed up our disclaimer. So I'm on the website, and I'm going to start this meeting where reading the disclaimer that's now on the website, which says, sorry, I'm trying to multitask here. The AXL website and recordings are provided as a service to registrants, registrant families, and others for general information only. The information on the website, the information on the website and in the recordings are not designed to provide legal or other advice or to create an attorney-client relationship. You should not take or refrain from taking action based on their content. Prior results and case studies do not guarantee a similar outcome in future representations. AXL accepts no responsibility for any loss or damages that may result from accessing or reliance upon content on the AXL website or in the recordings, and disclaim to the fullest extent permitted by applicable law any and all liability with respect to the acts or omissions made by registrant, registrant's families, and others on the basis of the content on the AXL website and in its recordings. And folks, this disclaimer is going to basically protect you as well as AXL. It's now on our website, and you'll see on every article that's posted, this disclaimer is repeated. So you will be reminded then. We'll all be reminded then. Okay. So one of the other things that we've done recently, and it's not new in this meeting, is in fact having a member of our AXL Board of Directors or the Family Safety Foundation join us. And so you get to know who they are. You get to know a little bit of who they are. You can ask them a question or two. We do have limited time for that, but talk about it for about 15 minutes. And I'm so delighted to have joining with us today, Catherine Carpenter. So I hope all of you already know who she is, but just in case you don't know, she is a legal academician extraordinaire. That's how I would describe Catherine Carpenter. She has all kinds of other titles, professor and associate dean and on. But the thing that first, the reason I first found out about Catherine Carpenter is in fact through her law review articles that she's written. And when I read the first one, it was so exciting to know that there was somebody who was in legal academics who really understood our issue and was really advocating for the same things that we advocate. So I think that's probably enough of an introduction, Catherine, though I could go on and on with your accolades. But please, welcome to this monthly meeting.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. For those that I already know, it's a pleasure to see you. I've enjoyed meeting you and being with you at our conferences. For those that I've never met, it is wonderful for my tent to broaden and my tent to grow bigger. I was blessed when in 2015, and I take that word seriously, when Janice approached me and said, would you like to join the Axol organization? At that point in time, we were still affiliated with ROCell. And I joined the board and have not looked back since, because I really appreciate what ROCell, Janice and Chance, and then the move to Axol was trying to do. And it was something that resonated with me personally. So since its founding, Axol has always been focused on one thing. Janice just mentioned it, and that's the community. That's the registrants that we serve. So to be part of that has been very exciting. I feel I'm now president, and I feel in a way that I've bought a house that's beautifully furnished. I didn't do anything to get this house, but I'm enjoying where we've been and where we're going. And so in addition to Janice, a huge thank you to Chance Oberstein, who served as president for 5 years in our first 5 years as Axol. And that's just been an extraordinary position for me to take over. I think that Janice is going to speak about a lot of positive things. We talk about New Year's resolutions. We're already the third week of January. If you're like me, you've already put them aside. Maybe you've already broken them all. Maybe you never even made any. But Axol has a resolution. There's no question about it. And our resolution in our commitment to everybody in our community is really threefold. And I think we're going to continue that, and you're going to hear it loudly. And that is, it's through legislation or lobbying, as we were talking earlier, through litigation and through education. And I just wanted to spend a couple of minutes to tell you what's on the horizon for all of us, so that you know, even between the monthly meetings, Janice, the board, we're working very, very hard for you behind the scenes. So in terms of legislation, we know that in our world, in California, certainly across the country for all of you, but in our world, Sacramento is our home away from home. And in fact, Janice is there all the time. We know that we need to be talking to, continuing to talk to legislators. And Janice, some board members, so familiar with walking the halls in Sacramento. Just a few days ago, Janice is probably going to talk about it, but I want to champion her for it. Just a few days ago, Janice spoke to the California Sex Offense Management Board, CASOM. They invited her to come and make a presentation to them, which was incredible. She wasn't pounding on that door. They said, please come talk to us. We think that you actually have some incredible advice to give us. She came with a beautiful presentation that was succinct. It went straight to the point. It was about the tiered registry, and it was about the changes that have to be made to it. And you could feel and hear the board members leaning in to the presentation. She had 7 proposals. Some were easy to fix. Some required many more things to consider. But there wasn't a single proposal that a board member said, that's nonsense. That's not possible. Instead, they listened to what she said. And I think that's going to start being our marching orders for this coming year. Those 7 proposals to continue, not just with CASOM, but through other parts of the community. One of the things that I've learned in my role as a professor, the more people you can talk to, not just our own community, but outside our community, the more people you can talk to, the more people you can reach, the more likely there is change. So that's very exciting. We have Lobbying Day coming up in March. We're going to be in Sacramento, pounding those halls to talk about these proposals and to meet with legislators and their staffs about it. That's very, very exciting. We have a kind of a pie in the sky wish as well, which we think is great for the state of California, not just for our community, but for everybody. This is thinking about the long haul, thinking about the, or they would call the long ball. And that is that we want to add reputation to our state constitution. 26 states have reputation as a liberty interest. And I don't have to share with all of you who are registrants what that could mean for our community. Reputation has been slammed and slandered, and folks don't even care. But that's because we haven't made reputation front and center like other states have. Now, other states have reputation front and center for a variety of reasons, mostly in the workplace, what employers can say about their employees. But we think getting it into the California Constitution would be good for everybody. And so we've begun research on it. And that's the beauty of being a law professor, having law students at hand who are smart and savvy and allies for this cause, who have been doing some research on what the other states do with respect to reputation. At this point, I also want to mention that I've been very, very lucky to be the beneficiary of a board member members funds, significant funds, so that I could start a little organization on campus called Access to Restorative Justice Fund, where I can bring speakers out, where I can hire research assistants, where I can spread the word there. So that's been wonderful. And here we'll come out with our legislative angle. The second thing that we do is litigation. And we have a pit bull at the helm in Janice. And so Janice, as our executive director and a civil rights attorney, has brought numerous lawsuits on behalf of Axol in coordination with Axol. And sometimes when Axol is the primary party, the board is very involved in this. When Chance was president, we would talk about these lawsuits. Janice would keep us informed about the lawsuits, and we worked hard to help her have a clear path for these lawsuits. It's because of Janice, and I don't say this lightly, it's because of Janice that we don't have the kind of presence restrictions, residency restrictions, Halloween nonsense that other states still have, because we sued and cities backed down. And if they didn't back down, we stayed in their face and they paid us damages. So then they rest of the cities started to back down, 82 cities, because of that kind of litigation. And Janice has, I'm sure, going to talk to you about other litigation on our horizon, on the forefront, to help everybody here. I believe in litigation because as much as we need to have our legislators, I think that we're seeing movement in the courts. It's slow. And for that, I'm disappointed. But we are seeing positive movement at the appellate level, recognizing all the noise that the public is hearing isn't true, pushing through the false data about recidivism rates. And slowly, we're starting to see appellate courts saying, we understand. We realize that the state is holding a bluff hand, that they really don't have anything to support their position. So I am hopeful that more appellate court decisions are going to come forward, or trial court decisions are going to come forward, that I'm sure Janice is going to talk about. The last thing, I couldn't finish my introduction without mentioning education. I believe deeply that we need to continue our education with the public, education with law schools, education with the legal community. So that's why I write law review articles. They are cited up and down, for which I'm grateful, because that means the message is getting out. Let me share that on Monday, I don't even think Janice knows this yet, a student group approached me and said, do you think you could set up a panel presentation at the school for the end of January? Because we want to hear from people intimately familiar with the registry. So it wouldn't be like my presentation talking about the law. Could you really get people to talk to us? And I said, let me put out two calls. I put out a call to Chance as a former registrant and as a lawyer who helps the registrants, and to Dr. Jay Rice, who some of you may have met, whose kid was on the registry. Both said yes immediately. And on Monday, they are going to be in a panel presentation with the law students in my school. And everybody's very, very excited about that. In terms of education, we are going to continue to bring in guest speakers. And we're going to look to create a CLE this spring for lawyers in California who need to learn about the tiered registry. And Janice and Chance are experts in that area and will help us out with that. So we're trying to do that on the education front as well. Whenever there's a chance to speak, Janice and I, we do rock, paper, scissors. Do you want to speak? Should I speak? Well, who's going to go? Because the more groups we can talk to, the more we can get the word out. And so this last spring, we spoke to the forensic psychological community. We've been approached again to speak to a different community like that. This is the kind of thing that's so important for us to do. Then finally, I want to share that one of the things we realize, and Marty talked about it a little bit briefly in the emotional support group, and part of the reason that the panel presentation is going to happen on Monday is we know stories are really important. Humanizing the face of registrants is really important, but it's so hard to do, and we recognize that. This is why we're so happy to have that panel presentation under the heading, really, of storytelling, of sharing our stories with the community. So let me once again thank Janice for inviting me here. Thank Chance for leaving the house in such good shape for me to take it over. And I have I want to hang out for a couple of minutes. I have a 10:30 where I'm coaching a moot court team. That's one of my other titles. So I have to head off to go coach them. But thank you, Janice.
And thank you, Catherine. That was wonderful information, and your inspiration to us all. I think Catherine does have a few minutes. If anybody has a question or comment, please put your hand up. It's better if you do it using those buttons on the bottom because I can only see a few of you in photos. So if anybody has a question or comment for Catherine, this is a good time to do it before we jump into a really pretty long list of topics to discuss.
Or you could put it in the chat. I've got the chat open. And I'm happy to read that.
Okay, that's a good idea too, Catherine. All right, so I don't see any hands up right now.
Oh, I see a hand, Gian.
Okay. Oh, there we go. Thank you. I've gone to the other end of the queue. Gian, you're unmuted now.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. I'm just going to go by Mike. I have a certificate of rehabilitation. I've gone through all the processes. I have a governor's pardon. I'm an 80% service-related disabled veteran. And I've reached out to politicians to get help with the governor's pardon. I can't seem to get any help. I've reached out several times. And, you know, I have a huge portfolio. I'm on tier three. Nothing was looked at. I'm still on tier three. It's been over 20 years. And
I'm going to interrupt you and I'm not going to mute you because it's not a topic. So we're happy to have you join us at another time. But right now, Catherine Carpenter is with us for just a few more minutes. So I'm going to lower your hand as well. So maybe when it comes time to when we're talking about the tiered registry, it might be in a more appropriate time for your question or comment. So folks, again, time is passing quickly here for Catherine Carpenter, and she's going to go head up a moot court presentation. So I'm going to go ahead and start the meeting, Catherine, if you see any other hands or whatever.
One that I think would be good, and then I'll say goodbye.
Okay.
Dwayne, it was about the notion of reputation and how other states are aligning reputation. And one of the positive things to end on, actually, is the reason we got this idea is because of Pennsylvania appellate courts. The Pennsylvania appellate courts want to use reputation as a fundamental right to talk about a different legal document, a different legal doctrine, basically saying, if you don't have the real facts and you're not telling the truth about the real facts, you can't create these kind of classic schemes that divide people up by underlying facts that aren't true, and it hurts their reputation. And so in a wonderful line of cases, which is what gave us the inspiration to say, we need to go about really using reputation. It's kind of a short, unlegal way of talking about it, but that's the reason that we got into this. And now we're doing the research, Dwayne, to see what reputation really looks like across the field, how they're using it. That's going to take us a little longer, but we're looking forward to it.
Wonderful. Okay. And for those of you who like legal vocabulary, add this one, the irrebuttable presumption doctrine.
Which is actually a great phrase. I just want to say irrebuttable presumption, meaning registrants recidivate at high rates. It's stuck in stone and it's wrong. And that's why it should be overturned.
Absolutely. Thank you, Catherine, for those closing words.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Have a great meeting. And thank you, Chance, again, and Janice.
You're welcome. Thank you. Okay. So probably the number one issue we're going to discuss today is a court decision that came out 8 days ago. So I assume that a lot of people on the call today are interested in SORNA. So we're going to just jump into that after a few announcements. So I announced who Catherine Carpenter is. I think most of you know who Chance Oberstein is, but just in case you're not, maybe you are joining our monthly Zoom meeting here for the first time. Chance Oberstein is, in fact, a criminal defense attorney. He has represented a lot of people on the registry. He continues to represent a lot of people on the registry, and he has a fantastic string of success in getting people removed from the registry. Chance is also the immediate past president of the board of directors, and he is a current member of the board of directors, and we're really happy to have him join us. Anything else you want to say, Chance, an introduction? Chance, you need to unmute yourself. Sorry.
There we go.
Excellent.
Okay. What I really want to say is thank you for allowing me to be here today. And also I want to just give a shout out to Catherine. I just want to say what a fantastic new president we have. And I wish her all the luck in the world, and I will support her efforts to do exactly what she said she's going to do. And I think this is a great new year and a great new start. So we're all just blessed and lucky to have her working with Janice. And I'm so pleased.
Absolutely. Okay. So, before we get to talk about SORNA, just a few, I call them announcements. One is, folks, is about the scams. So I don't know, 'tis the season for scams, or maybe during the holiday was the season for scams. They're happening more and more, it appears, at least on reports that I'm getting. We've added an article on the Axel website about the scams, and we've made it, quote, sticky, so it's going to be there for a while. Just to remind you that when you get a phone call from somebody who represents themselves as law enforcement, and they tell you, do not hang up because we're coming to get you, or we're going to come pick you up on a warrant, you know, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, it's a scam, folks. It is a scam. A lot of times these days, they seem to be using DNA as a reason or an excuse. You know, your DNA sample was compromised, it was lost, whatever it was. If I were you, the minute I heard DNA, I would just hang up on them. And in fact, that is the best thing to do when you get one of these scam calls. And the worst thing to do with one of these scam calls is to get the money. And unfortunately, we have people who are giving thousands of dollars. The biggest one I've heard is $10,000. I think, Chance, you've even heard of somebody providing them with even more than $10,000. We're here to protect you folks, including from these scammers. So it's really easy to get rid of them. You just hang up the phone. Now, some people get a whistle. They want to blow a whistle in the ear. Some people want to curse at them. Well, we can't say no to that. It's not illegal. But on the other hand, just hang up. It's, you use a lot less of your energy if you just hang up. Okay. The other thing has to do with Lobby Day. We're going to talk about this in some greater detail later, but March 21 is Lobby Day here in Sacramento. If you're in the state of California and you're able, please join us on March 21 for Lobby Day. It's going to be different. I'm Italian. I promise you will be fed. Your parking will be paid for. And so we have a few more resources than we've had in the past. Thank you, Dave. And so we're just going to make sure that you're well taken care of. And guess what? The legislators, most of them are not even in the Capitol anymore, but they're on the other side of the Capitol. So we all go get to see a brand new building. I visited that building last week. It's got its own pluses and minuses, including the fact that you cannot go into an office without a mask, despite all certain court rulings. But that's okay. We'll bring boxes of masks with us just in case you don't have one. So again, just if you could, save the date, and that's March 21. So no further ado here. Let's jump into SORNA. Chance and I have been talking about SORNA and these regulations, oh my goodness, for over 2 years. And in some respects, I feel like a broken record saying, beware, beware, beware of the SORNA regulations. So it was wonderful with another organization that has so many more resources than we do, decided that they wanted to challenge these regulations in court. And they talked to Chance, they talked to me, they talked to other actual board members and asked us about how was the best way to engage. The attorneys, by the way, from that organization on their East Coast, they paid for their own airfare to come to California to meet with us. This is how dedicated they are. They're not asking us to fly to the East Coast to meet with them or just do things like Zoom meetings. And one of the things that we did actually was help them identify potential plaintiffs in the lawsuit. So there was a big decision that was rendered by the court about 8 days ago, and we certainly want to discuss that and discuss what may potentially happen after this. So I'm going to start out the discussion, and I'm sure, Chance, that you'll join me in adding to it. But let's put it this way. It was a victory. It was a significant victory that a federal district court judge granted injunction. Federal district court judges do not like to grant injunctions in general. They try to avoid it, actually, at all costs, if they can. So this judge was willing to take a big step for a federal judge and to grant this injunction. Having said that, he didn't grant everything in the injunction that we wanted him to. Okay. So for one thing, it's limited geographically to the state of California. Well, I'm sure that's a problem for the registrants in the other 49 states. Having said that, I will say that to me, there is an open invitation in this decision to file similar lawsuits in other states. It says that this could be filed, you know, similar lawsuits can be filed in other states. Hint, hint. It's one sentence in a 56-page decision, but judges don't usually say things like that. Another open invitation in this decision, quite frankly, was that this federal, he's a district court judge, which is at the lowest level in the federal judiciary. He said, basically, take my decision to the U.S. Supreme Court if they'll hear it. And that's a big deal as well. Usually judges don't like to be overturned. Right. So on one issue, it's a non-delegation doctrine or separation of powers, this judge said, my hands are tied. He said, I believe he said, I'm leaning in your direction, but my hands are tied by prior decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. And this whole notion of stare decisis, which the current U.S. Supreme Court may or may not feel like it's wedded to, since it has overturned a few other decisions already that were on books for many years. So I think that's the first thing. So I want to say, Chance, I'd love to hear what your initial comments are, and then we can take comments from you all, questions from you all. I can just imagine that folks have a lot of questions.
Okay. Well, I'd like to just simplify this a little bit. Chance's interpretation, but what I got from this judge, even before we made this decision, is I think he saw the issue and he wanted to help. And one of the things I see in his decision, and this happened over discussion of whether a California dismissal was unique, the Department of Justice said it was twice in their reviews, because our particular dismissals really don't have any penal consequences. As a matter of fact, they don't. And it was an interesting argument. And if you watched the first hearing between the government and the petitioner, you'd have to ask yourself, what in the hell was the government saying? But it got under his skin because, you know, it was kind of like the government was speaking with a forked tongue. The dismissals have never changed. Once they had no penal consequences, now they do. What was that penal consequence? Oh, the fact that people have to keep on registering. It's punitive, right? But here's the real flaw in that logic. According to the Supreme Court, it's administrative. So that was an interesting thing that the government dropped on this judge, which I think even made the situation worse. In essence, what the judge did is protect our remedy, our California remedy. Okay. So he protected those who have been removed from the registry in California from having to adhere to these rules until this litigation is over. And it's a good prediction that this litigation is going to be successful, because the judge wouldn't stick his neck that far unless he thought it was so. The litigation is about delegation of powers. But, you know, in lieu of that, you know, should the rules be suspended? I believe he should have been comprehensive and just covered the whole gambit. I think everybody should have been included in this, but I understand where he was going with that. And in particular, the uniqueness of California and the remedy, he protected it. And I just that's fabulous, because, you know, that really goes part and parcel with, you know, our old remedy of certificate of rehabilitations and our new remedy of tier removal. So I appreciate that. Comprehensive, no, but substantive, yes. I'm looking for more traction in the future. I loved the way he discussed things. And I want to note that he didn't say that, as far as he could see, that dismissals didn't drop California out of the definition of SORNA. He said that there was nothing that he could see from the arguments presented that the government was wrong. Now, you know, I think that's still an open question. I just don't think that the proper subject matter, which is really penal consequences, was developed by either party. And that would have been very uncomfortable for the government, given what they said. So that's where I stand on this. But I appreciate what was done. I'm so happy that it came down that way. But I wish it was more comprehensive.
Thank you, Chance. And again, folks, if you want to ask a question, make a comment about this, please raise your hand. If you can do it using the reactions button at the bottom of your screen, that would help a lot, because we can see you. It actually moves you to the front of the list. So while Chance was talking, I went back to the decision so I could read to you one sentence from the decision, because I know we have people on the call today who are not from California, and we welcome you, and we're so glad that you're joining us. But here it says, so if there are similar issues outside of California, residents of other states should, he used the word should, file their own challenges. So I want you all to know that that one sentence right there to me is like a match being lit on a big ton of dynamite, or something similar, legally speaking. And I'm already speaking to attorneys outside of the state of California and talking to them about what states these next challenges should be filed. I think, you know, why not take the lawsuit that's already been filed? You can't exactly cut and paste, but you can get pretty close to it. And you have to choose your plaintiffs carefully. There's no doubt about that. But this is an invitation right here. Hey, plaintiffs. Hey, Axel. Hey, other registrants in other states. File your own lawsuit, and I think you're going to get similar results. And Gus, I see your hand up. Go ahead and unmute you.
Yeah, so I thanks again for everything that you do. This is such a soul-saving meeting for me to get you know, a positive feedback or feeling when some horrible things are going on in reference to my state, particularly in Florida. So along those lines, I wanted to ask you, is Florida, I imagine the invitation is open to all states, and that includes Florida as well, correct? And I wonder, and I'm wondering if you're in contact with Florida Action Committee, or should I relay this to them to advise them to take a look at this?
You know, Gus, if you have a contact within Florida Action Committee, I think it's a good idea for you to reach out to them. We have not reached out to Florida yet. And I'll tell you the reason why. Florida is going to be a difficult state. I have to admit, I'm looking for a friendlier state. There are friendlier states out there than Florida. That doesn't mean we should ignore Florida, though, Gus, and we certainly need to get there. But yes, if you could make sure that they're aware of this decision, that would be great. I can't remember if they put it on their website or not, this decision, but that's a good idea. Thank you.
And okay, I will reach out to them. Yeah, I will definitely reach out to them. And just so I get an overall feeling on this, this decision is particularly just in reference to people that have been taken off the registry and their requirement to be on SONRA, or this is just a complete attack on SONRA's constitutionality and that it should not even apply to people in general?
The latter, Gus. So it applies in California, in the state of California, to everybody who's on the registry currently, as well as those who have gotten off the registry in California. So it is a comprehensive decision that way. Yes.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And folks, really, this is one of the reasons that I'm so excited about this decision, is because this could provide, it could be serve as a model, right, for other federal district court judges to follow this example. Now, it's not technically a precedent because it's only a trial court decision, but you know, these judges, they look at each other and then they look at their decision, each other's decisions, and like, well, what did my colleague over there in California do? And, you know, do I think similarly? And the other thing is, even if we get a court that disagrees, quite frankly, that might get us to the U.S. Supreme Court faster. So when you have different decisions in different states and certainly in different circuit courts of appeal, then the U.S. Supreme Court is more likely to an issue and a decision. We don't know. We don't know. I mean, this could be the case that ends up in the U.S. Supreme Court and that the U.S. Supreme Court makes some really important decisions. I mean, wouldn't it be incredible if they said, you know, we made a mistake only a mere 20 years ago now. We made a mistake by saying that, you know, the reoffense rate for people in the registry is, quote, frightening and high. They did make a mistake. They made a huge mistake, and it's had profound consequences. And so any day now, I'm talking any day now in lawyer terms, which probably means any year now, I am hopeful that the U.S. Supreme Court will come to their senses and correct their mistake. But anyway, we're not there yet, but this is exciting. And it really provides us with some great opportunities. I see your hand up, Marty. I'm going to unmute you here. But I want to say, too, that a little bit more singing the praises of the Pacific Legal Foundation that took up this challenge, and they're devoting their resources to it. So it's not just flying their attorneys back and forth from California, but also, I mean, there's considerable resources, folks, that are required, filing the lawsuit, filing the motion for preliminary injunction, not once, but twice. Okay, so they've had to do that twice already. And the fact is, the Pacific Legal Foundation, too, they have a staff of more than 40 attorneys. I'm so jealous, and I'm so happy for them. And they have taken 17 cases. This organization has taken 17 cases to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've won 14 of them. That's a darn good track record. And I'm really glad they're on our side. All right, Marty, what do you have to add?
Well, actually, I have a question for you, and it's really more personal than anything else. Your opinion, knowing how conservative our Supreme Court is at this point in time, what do you think the chances are that if this does get to the Supreme Court, that they will, we'll just say that this passes?
You know, this is my personal opinion, that I think that this court is capable of doing anything and surprising us all on every issue. And the other thing I will say, you know, there's a certain president who basically got three of these justices appointed. And he was a Republican. Okay. He was a Republican. But the fact is, Republicans don't support us. Democrats don't support us. And the fact that Pacific Legal Foundation is a libertarian organization is fine with me. I mean, we're not in agreement with everything that PLF has ever done. I'm not personally. The organization isn't. In fact, we had a board member or two who questioned, why in the world would we want to basically associate ourselves with the Pacific Legal Foundation? And I said, because right now we have common interests. I have intersecting interests. It may not be forever. It may just be for this one case. Who knows? But then back to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that it's capable. I think any court is capable of waking up and agreeing, waking up to the fact they've made a mistake and agreeing to correct it. What do you think, Champs?
Well, it's, you know, first of all, Marty, this is not about us. So please don't get that impression, because this is a delegation of powers issue. Okay. This is whether or not the Attorney General has the right to legislate, you know, beyond delegation powers. And so the answer, I think, and this is my opinion, the answer is that the Supreme Court in a case called Gundy made it very clear. They don't like things like this. And this is really made for a victory at the Supreme Court level because of the parameters set in Gundy. So I'm going to say that this is the type of case that probably I think would be seen as favorable. And also, it was very, very important how they tailored it, who the plaintiffs were. I mean, this was done with perfection. So, you know, the preliminary hearing was about, or not preliminary hearing, but the preliminary injunction was about us, okay, and the rules, because of the delegation of powers issue. But ultimately, it's a delegation of powers issue. So this may play very well with this particular Supreme Court. That's my opinion.
Thanks. Keep my fingers crossed.
Okay.
Yeah, there are, and the PLF attorney did a really good job highlighting justices who in the past have made comments about the non-delegation doctrine, and including who were in the dissent, I guess, in Gundy. And so those were highlighted, not only in PLF's briefs, but also in this decision. So there were quite a few pages of this decision. It's a 56-page decision, by the way, that are devoted to discussing the non-delegation doctrine and that U.S. Supreme Court decision, Gundy, and saying, isn't it interesting that this justice dissented and that justice dissented and one concurred, but, you know, had a problem with the outcome. So anyway, I think it's possible. Thanks for that question, Marty.
My pleasure. May I add one thing real quick?
Sure.
Just a statement that I've made a number of times, and I'll probably make it a number of other times to everyone who is watching right now. These court cases, they get to, you know, they help us out. They help us, you know, with these ridiculous laws, because we have brave, courageous registrants and loved ones who actually step up and say, all right, you know what, I'll be a litigant. I've done it a number of times. And everyone here, if you want these laws to be dismantled, just privately tell Janice, you know, I want to be a litigant in these cases, and you can make a big difference. And I tell you something, those times that we win, the celebration is wonderful.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Janice.
You're welcome. I do remember, I'll call it the bad old days, when we first filing lawsuits challenging presence restrictions and residency restrictions. And oh my goodness, you know, we really had a hard time finding people who would be plaintiffs. Frank Lindsay was our plaintiff in many of our original cases. And even in the beginning, Frank was John Doe. And then he finally said, what the heck? You know, what difference does it make in my life? My life has already been threatened. Somebody's already broken into my house. How could things be worse? So anyway, he said, heck with it. I'm going to use my real name. And he has in the last many years, because we've been doing this for about 12 years now. And for about 10 of those years, Frank Lindsay has said, go ahead, use my name. And by the way, some people have been asking about an update about Frank Lindsay's health. And so just to make sure everybody knows, Frank Lindsay got very sick in November, and he went into the hospital with COVID, and he was on a ventilator at one time. His daughter told me she thought that his chance of survival was low. And to our great, wonderful surprise, Frank survived COVID, being on a ventilator, et cetera. And so he's now living at home, and he is now on oxygen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He is trying to go back to work, which may or may not be a good idea. But he's, you know, stubborn. Oh, I'm sorry, tenacious, like I am. And so, and he's already said, you know, he's probably not going to make it to the annual lobby day this year. And he's really sad about that. But we know what's best for Frank is for him to heal completely, you know, before he reengages, because right now he does have a compromised immune system as well. And we certainly don't want to spread any germs, you know, of our germs with him or any other germs with him as he would travel. So that is the Frank Lindsay update. Somebody asked a question in the chat room here about, well, what, let's see, I'm going to read the exact question. Does anyone know the SCOTUS case that ruled SORNA to be administrative? Well, it's not just SORNA, but the whole registry, is administrative. That decision is Smith versus Doe. And I know it's an extremely boring name, but it has such a huge impact and has been harming registrants for the last 20 years. So it's called Smith versus Doe. It was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court in March of 2000, so 20 years ago. So that's what we're up against. And I know fans of me and every attorney working with registrants, that term frightening and high keeps getting thrown in our face. We know that it's not true. And the great thing about that irrebuttable presumption doctrine that Catherine Carpenter was talking about just a few minutes ago is it shifts the burden. So instead of the government being able to wave its arms around and say, public safety, right? Or, you know, frightening and high. Sometimes I think they sound like a squawking parrot. But for so long, the courts have let them get away with that. And now the courts are saying, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe you government have to prove frightening and high. Maybe you have to prove, you know, these claims that you are making instead of just accepting it to be true. So that's why the states that have the right to reputation have a leg up on the irrebuttable presumption doctrine. States like Pennsylvania and that great case that came out in fall of last year, Torsellari, I believe is the name of the decision. And so we're looking for other states where that doctrine can be applied. But in order to get your biggest bang for the buck, folks, you have to have a right of reputation in your constitution. So,
Janice, if I just could add something real quick to the Smith discussion, and I think that people get lost in the weeds in this. The decision was really about double jeopardy, if you think about it. Just think about it theoretically, okay? You get convicted of a crime, you know, you can't be sentenced to do twice the punishment for one crime. That's a violation of your constitutional right, double jeopardy. What the Supreme Court did is they legitimized that. What they said was, you can be punished once and you can be punished twice, okay? And they said it in this way. You're not being punished twice because the registry is administrative and therefore doesn't constitute punishment. And it was rationalized that it was like, you know, being a member of Price Club or something like that. But the truth is that once you're being punished and twice you're being punished again. So you're walking violations of double jeopardy. Every single registrant in this country is a walking violation of double jeopardy. And when you're punished twice, if you violate that punishment, you're punished a third time. Okay, what it's done in essence in violating our basic concept of double jeopardy is created a subclass. And that is why we're all sitting here today and having this meeting, because it's a subclass based on a false, and I mean totally false, mythology that this needed to be done in order to protect the public. Okay, and that is a nutshell of what Smith is all about.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. And by the way, one of our former board members and a legal academic, Ira Ellman and his wife, Tara Ellman, they put together a scholarly paper about frightening and high. And through their research, and they're willing to do research that I'm not willing to do because they spent, I don't know, countless months digging. But this is what they found, that the reason that the court said that the reoffense rate was frightening and high is because they took one statement out of an issue of Psychology Today magazine. What? And that one statement wasn't even based upon research. It was basically a marketing statement made by one psychologist. And so the U.S. Supreme Court based its whole decision on one statement made in a Psychology Today magazine. I mean, that's not even, it's not a journal, you know, it's not an academic journal of any kind. It's just a magazine we can all buy, you know, at the newsstand. And I don't give it any credibility and therefore I don't buy it, but the magazine. But the fact is that most people understand that. And I don't know how the U.S. Supreme Court ended up relying upon that, but that's for another day.
But I'll give you a hint. Justice Cardozo from New York. What the court did is they Cardozoed us. With Justice Cardozo, the Supreme Court, the widow always won no matter what. Okay. Because but you can come up with any justification for doing what you want to do. And that is exactly what Smith projects throughout its history. And everything's been built on the back of that. And so pretty much the state's doing exactly what it wants to do. And we have been wrestling with that problem in every single issue we take on as opposition to that one really bad bad case.
So I'm an optimist by nature, and because of that, I'm always looking for a silver lining. And this is a silver lining I see in Smith versus Doe. It's not based on fact, right? It's just not. It's based on nonsense. And so at some point in time, the U.S. Supreme Court's going to wake up and they're going to read Dr. Ellman's scholarly article or somebody who cites it and say, maybe we made a mistake way back when. Let's correct it. And Chance is absolutely right that, by the way, John Roberts, who is now the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, he was the attorney representing the state of Alaska in Smith versus Doe. Isn't that ironic? All right. So maybe he's in the best position ever to correct his mistake. But when he was asked during oral argument, and this is actually happening, you can read the transcript to back me, to, you know, if you want to challenge me, read the transcript of that oral argument. And he was asked, John Roberts was asked, is registration like applying for membership at Costco? Price, because it was Price Club at the time. And he said, yeah, well, I don't know about you, but I doubt the fact that he's ever been to Price Club or Costco for that matter, right? So he didn't know what he was talking about. And I would think most of the justices have never been there either, to Price Club. And certainly they haven't applied, because if you look at the application, it's like half a page long. And then you look at, you know, at the stack of laws in every single state that affect people's lives, you know, it's countless pages. That's hundreds of pages. It's not a half a page. So folks, the basis, the foundation of that decision is made out of sand or something even worse than sand. And so it's not going to hold forever. And for us, what can we do about it is we keep pushing. And someday it's going to topple over. I predict. I just hope I'm there when it happens. Okay, we've got a phone, a hand up from 916 area code ending in 869. I'm asking you to unmute yourself. And folks, if I don't ask you to unmute yourself, would you please mute yourself? Because otherwise we get background noises, children, dogs. Love children, love dogs, but we don't want to hear them this morning. Okay, please go ahead, sir or ma'am.
What I was wondering is, you mentioned the article in Psychology Today having such an impact 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Has anyone looked into whether Psychology Today has ever published anything counter to that?
You know what? I've been told that they do. And remember, I don't I don't subscribe to it. I don't even read it. But I've been told that they did, but the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't paid attention to it. That's a good question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
By the way, in addition, besides Psychology Today, there are so many studies and reports out there from academia, even from the government, quite frankly, that talk about what is the reoffense rate, right? What is the reoffense rate? That seems to be the multi-million dollar question. And here's a statistic I hope that you will remember so you can cite it at the drop of a hat. The rate of reoffense while a person is on parole is less than 1%. Less than 1%. Have you ever heard that statistic? If you had, it's probably because you listened to Chance and I in one of our previous meetings. But that is not out there for the public to hear. If what people are so darn worried about is if somebody on the registry is going to reoffend, then wouldn't you think that one statistic would be like something that everybody can quote? I think so. And so that's in the state of California while you're on parole. And oh, by the way, that's when people are supposedly most likely to reoffend. And what is it after that? And there's all kinds of answers and all kinds of reports, but it's usually around 4 to 5%. So 4 to 5% chance of reoffense. And understand that when I use the term reoffense, I'm talking about committing another sex offense, because there's another term that word that starts with RE, which is recidivism rate. That's not the same thing. The recidivism rate for people on the registry is quite high. And why is that? Mostly because of parole violations or probation violations. So what that means is somebody is returned to custody for something. It could be for shoplifting, for goodness sake, right? It's not because they committed another sex offense. So the other side likes to quote recidivism rates, and we're said, oh, no, we cry foul. The term you should be using, the thing you should be focusing on, is what is the reoffense rate. And Gus, you've got your hand up. Thank you for being patient. Please unmute yourself.
No worries. I wanted to quickly follow up on the comment that the gentleman made in reference to Psychology Today doing a retraction. I have not seen that, but I have seen, and I was trying to find it right now. I'm going to share it if I locate it, that the actual author himself said that, you know, this was a gentleman who was actually being a provider of counseling. So, of course, there's an embedded interest in there for him to say that it's private high because then he gets clients. But putting that aside, he has subsequently come out and said that, you know, kind of a retraction of what he actually mentioned on the original article. And I'm gonna find it as this goes on. I'll just post it on the chat. The other question I had was in reference to Justice Roberts. Forgive my ignorance. I imagine that they are not somebody that would be susceptible to people directly writing to them, or are they susceptible to people actually just sending them saying, listen, this is an article that you based a decision on and now subsequent information has come out. Would sending an article in mass to Justice Roberts be a good thing to do, or would that be a nuisance and they don't even bother looking at that?
Well, Gus, I think it has only a very small chance of success, but what the heck? The thing about David and Goliath, if you aim it properly, maybe it will hit that giant and knock him down. So go for it. Write a letter to Chief Justice Roberts. I think it's better for letters like that to come from members of the registrants instead of our organization. We're trying through more official avenues, I guess is the way I would say it. But why not give it a try?
Okay,
Champ,
great.
What do you think of that?
Well, I sometimes we get caught up in the weeds and we think that the justices believe that because they did not believe that. They did. They just picked something they could find in order to justify a position they wanted to take. That's what being Cardozo is all about. You know, have they changed their minds over the years? The more effective way of doing this, I think, is to, just like this article, Frightening and High, is to put together a brief, an amicus, that chronicles the outgrowth of this myth in terms of harm it's caused. Okay, that really is the more effective tool in showing the justices that decision, as wrong as it was at the time, is so pernicious and ugly, the outgrowth of which has caused so much harm, it must be reversed. That is really where the rubber meets the road.
And I agree. I agree with Chance and I agree with Gus. So there you go. We've definitely deviated from SORNA. So I'm assuming that means people don't want to discuss SORNA anymore or the lawsuit anymore. Or this decision is, but maybe not, because I have something else I want to say. Having talked to the lead attorney in this case, about what comes next, quite frankly, they're expecting the federal government to appeal this decision, to appeal the injunction and try to get the injunction stopped. So that's what is expected next. And we'll see if that comes to pass or not. If the federal government does not try to appeal the injunction, then the case can go to the merits. I mean, this, it's called a preliminary injunction for a reason, because it's preliminary. Another word is temporary. It's not a temporary restraining order, though, because a TRO has a really short duration. A preliminary injunction is meant to last for a longer period of time, but not forever. I guess is the way to put it, somewhere between now and infinity. So let's see what happens with the federal government. I'm just so curious about their posture. I mean, I think that they got what shellacking is that word I was trying to think of. I remember President Obama in the midterm elections, and you know, the other party won a lot of seats, and he called that a shellacking. Well, I think this is a shellacking here of the federal government and the Attorney General's office. And I hope they see it as that. It's like, or being taken to the woodshed or whatever. You know, come on, folks. You're really screwed up here. And a federal judge called you on it. And so what are you going to do about this? I don't know. If they have integrity, I'm not sure if they do, but if the agency has integrity, they should say, oops, we got caught with our hand in the cookie jar. Okay, we understand. And because I'm an optimist, I want to go a step further. What if they decide that they're just going to basically decide not to enforce this nationwide? That's a stretch even for me as an optimist, but I think it's within the realm of possibility. Probability is pretty low. What do you think, Chance?
From my vantage point, I think it's a matter of strategy. I think that, you know, at this point, they may want to cut their losses and get to the issue. Why? You know, because if they dig deeper here, maybe then some, maybe, you know, dismissals in California can be further defined. I mean, they can come out a lot worse. I would just cut my losses and get to the issue and see where we're at. So I think from that standpoint, if you're reasonable and, you know, you think, okay, well, you know, a little bit of damage here to my position, but not a whole lot. And I'm on my way to, you know, to litigate these issues. If they want to roll the dice, you know, there's an upside and there's a downside. The upside is maybe they can erase any gain. Downside is it could get a lot worse.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Marty just put something quite wonderful in the chat room for those who are interested. So there is the article that was mentioned earlier. It says from Reason, and they're on their website from the year 2017. And the author of the article, Robert Longo, I believe in this article, basically said, that's not what I meant to say, right? And he basically acknowledges that, and I have read this now that my memory has jogged. He's basically saying that, hey, it was a marketing statement that I made. It wasn't based on research. He's acknowledging that here. And he certainly never meant it to have the impact that it did have. And then I see another one. Gus, you put something in here about another article on another website. So maybe I haven't seen it. I don't know what it says, but you know, knowledge is good. A way to broaden your horizons, folks. So let's go ahead and move off of Sorna then. I think Chance, maybe we can talk about travel very briefly because we have a national audience right now. And after travel, just to let everybody know, we're going to briefly talk about military veterans and retirees briefly, and then we're going to go to California-centric issues. So why don't we just jump in here to travel. As far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, Chance, the rules haven't changed, right? It's just, you know, we really want you to be careful when you travel, whether you're traveling domestically or you're traveling overseas. Please be careful. Go educate yourself before you travel, because guess what? This is one of those examples where ignorance of the law is no excuse. And, you know, sometimes I see things as a minefield out there, and you could step on a mine and blow up. What do I mean by blow up? No, you're not going to explode, but you could end up in federal prison for 10 years. So, you know, I think that's a good thing to try to avoid. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I mean, if you're going to travel domestically, know where you're going and know what's expected, know where you stand in relation to what the laws are in that state. And if you're going to travel overseas, understand where you can go, where you shouldn't go, and what are the possible consequences of traveling given what your passport is currently, what state it's in currently. I think those are important issues.
Okay. So I will say, I've said it before, but I haven't said it in a while, and I think it bears repeating. If you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and the feds define that as under 18, even in your state, the definition might be different, but the federal government defines it as under 18. If you've been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you are currently required to register, the federal government may revoke your passport, okay, and issue a new passport with a unique identifier added to it. I hate to say this, but in order to help you navigate the minefield here, my personal recommendation is that you get a new if you don't already have a unique identifier, and only if those conditions apply, by the way. If you don't already have a unique identifier added to your passport, get a unique identifier added to your passport. Why would I say such an outrageous thing? It's because people have been stopped from traveling. They've been stopped in the middle of their traveling because their passport has been revoked without notice because it lacked a unique identifier. If you follow my recommendation, that's if you can ignore it, but if you choose to follow it, when you file your application for a passport, you must put in there a letter that accompanies your application. It's not even a box you can check on the application. You have to write them a letter and say, please add the unique identifier to my passport. I'm sorry. To me, that's the best thing to do, the most prudent thing to do, so that your passport, so you're able to travel as much as you can travel, given the fact that some countries are not going to let you enter anyway. Chance, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I understand, you know, the premise of that, and I understand that it helps, you know, unimpeded travel. But until you're required to do so by law, I wouldn't. And if you're intending to travel, that may be an issue. I mean, you know, and I'm certain that Janice has handled these issues where people get stuck in the muck. But, you know, if you're asking me to do something extraordinary in order to you know, do something that I just totally think is just completely over the top. I can't in a principled way say that. I myself would rather not travel than to say, here, stigmatize me so I can go out and put myself in jeopardy all over the world. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. This is personally, you know, I will comply with the law and do what the law says I have to do. And if the federal government says, hey, you got to turn in your passport, you got to turn in your passport, and they've got to do what they're going to do. But if they're not going to do that, short of that, I'd rather not travel than to be stigmatized in that way.
And, you know, Chance, I agree with what you just said. I do. And the reason that I said what I just said is because I had a client who consulted with me prior to his travel overseas. He and his wife are going overseas to celebrate their 30th wedding anniversary. They're going to Europe, to a country that normally allows registrants to enter. And he was, you know, on the plane with his wife. They were already seated when the Department of Homeland Security came on the plane and took him off the plane. Okay. The bags had already been checked. They'd already paid thousands upon thousands of dollars for 3 weeks of accommodations in Europe. And guess what? It all went down the drain. So the most conservative, chances are even be more conservative than I am. Just don't travel overseas for now. Okay. Just don't travel overseas because you don't want to have unique identifiers added to your passport, and you certainly don't want it to have happen to you what happened to my client. And I know other people too who've gotten to the airport and been told they can't travel overseas for one reason or the other. One gentleman, it was a business trip. He was trying to go to South Korea for a meeting with his client. It was a big, large South Korean company, and he was able to buy a ticket online. He tried to get a boarding pass online. That didn't work. He went to the kiosk at the airport. That didn't work. Until finally he went to the counter. And they said, explained to him, no, we're not going to let you on our flight. And it was American Airlines. This is not Korean Airlines. It was an American Airlines flight. And they said, you're not going to be allowed to enter South Korea. So you can imagine he was in quite the panic because he had this really important business meeting that was scheduled in South Korea, and he wasn't able to attend it. As it turned out, he had a colleague who was supposed to travel with him, and the colleague had to take it by himself. So we're trying to give you, you know, the benefit of our experiences and things we've heard from others. And that's why we say the things we do. And if you ever notice that lawyers don't always agree with each other, it's like going to a doctor, right? Going to multiple doctors. And that's why people get second opinions from doctors, right? Because not all doctors agree. Okay, Rafael, you've been very kind and patient waiting. And I think you have a question or comment. Rafael, we can't hear you. You need to unmute yourself. There you go.
Okay, so the 21-day notice was a certain condition. Are we still having to do that since it's been rescinded?
Well, that wasn't part of the new regulations. That's been in existence for quite some time, so I don't think the injunction applies to that. But that's a good question. And what do you think, Chance?
Well, I think it does. As a matter of fact, if what the injunction does is it says to those who have been relieved of the obligation to register, either you know through certificate of rehabilitation or by being taken off the registry through the tier system, you're free to travel. Okay. What, you know, with everyone else, including people in California and all over the United States, they still have to adhere to these rules until otherwise, until this case is otherwise decided. And your particular question goes to IML in particular. And 21 days notice is still warranted if you fall into the definition of IML.
IML being if you have a minor on your record, right? But if you don't have a minor, is that part of IML?
No, that's correct. It applies to registrants who have convictions involving minors.
Thank you.
And thank you. Okay, so does anyone know the name and phone number of the attorney in Mexico? Jeff, I'm not quite sure what you're talking about here, though I believe that there was that Paul Rigney had an attorney in Mexico that he consulted with. Chance, do you know anything more than that?
No, not at all. Not at all.
So, Jeff, who asked that question, how about if you contact me by email or by phone? I believe everybody in the world has my phone number. Give me a little break after this meeting so I can have some lunch. But I can give you Paul Rigney's contact information. I think you need to talk to Paul directly. Okay, so Scott, you've got your hand up here. I'm asking you to unmute yourself, sir. Hi, Scott.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Nice to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I've been looking into travel to the Schengen's countries.
Yes.
And I'm coming up with this new ETIAS, which may kick in this year, which is the pre-application visa to the Schengen nations. I notice also that there's a section in there to applying to the ETIAS, those with a criminal record. And I noticed that a criminal record really doesn't keep you from applying or getting accepted through ETIAS, but there are certain things that deal with a history of sex crimes that does. It talks about having sexual exploitation with children or rape cases will prevent you from entering the Schengen countries. Luckily, my offenses don't include that, but it might be interesting for other members who plan to go to the Schengen countries.
And Scott, we have a comment here in the chat that ETIAS was postponed. So I don't think that it's currently in effect, but maybe the best thing to do is to travel to Europe as soon as you can before that happens. The other thing about Europe, folks, is that they have something that I think is quite wonderful and reasonable that should be applied here in the United States as well, which is the right to be forgotten, right? So they think within their right of privacy is the right to be forgotten. And I don't remember how many years, you know, I think it might be 7 or something like that, or maybe I'm thinking about California law, but that's in effect in only a few places. But they have a right to be forgotten. And so when you have a conviction that is X number of years old or older, they don't even consider it. So I would hope, Scott, since I know a little bit about your personal situation and how long ago you were convicted, perhaps you would not, you know, your conviction was old enough that it wouldn't even be considered.
Yes, I think they said if it's within the last 10 years.
Okay.
But I also see that they're talking about having it being enacted this year, 2023, is what they're stating.
All right. So that I have that comment from you. And then we have a comment from somebody named Mike, if you look in the chat room here, who said it was postponed. So I don't know if it was postponed until 2023 or it's been postponed beyond 2023. I think that's a good question. So why don't I do this? Why don't I prepare myself next month to discuss that? Oh, there you go. And is that Scott or Mike?
No, this is Scott, but it looks like it's coming through in reverse.
No, I see it. I see it correctly.
Oh, you can read it? Okay.
Yeah. So, folks, that's a great idea, Scott. So Scott's sharing the resources with us. If you have a specific question before next month's meeting, why don't you go to that website and maybe you can look it up for yourself. So David W. says, I believe ETIAS was postponed until October of this year. Don't know if that's true or not. Oh, there you go. I like this. You know, this is an interesting way of doing things. Scott, thank you for but maybe you can stop moving it around because.
Yeah, sorry. I was just trying to bring it into the frame.
Yeah.
But
that's okay. I think you've given us enough by giving us the website address. So thank you so much.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Well,
bye.
I'm going to mute you now. Okay. And put your hand down. All right. So here we are. We're talking about travel. Chance and I have been talking about travel for years. I wish I had recorded myself early on. We could just play the recording, right, Chance? But now we would never do that. We want to give you information. So here's somebody saying a friend was stopped going back to Vietnam to be with his family. And the Vietnam ambassador spoke on his behalf and Vietnam told the U.S. to let him come back. I love that. I love it when other countries stand up to us. You know, I mean, folks, think about it. Why is one reason that countries listen to the United States a lot of the time just because we send them a lot of money? And I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying, you know, that gets their attention. I understand. It's kind of like when your parents put you on allowance. You didn't want to, you know, upset the parents because then they stopped your allowance. I understood that. I figured that out pretty early. And so I think these other countries are figuring it out too. It's like, oh my God, the U.S. is going to cut off our allowance if I do something that upsets them. So a lot of countries are doing what the U.S. tells them to do, even though it makes no sense. And here's one example. We have countries on this planet where the age of consent is 12, not 18. It's 12. So if a 12-year-old has sex or you have a sex with a 12-year-old, it's legal in that country. And yet you are being, you know, getting the scarlet letter put on your forehead and your passport because you had sex with a 17-year-old. Folks, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, sometimes Law doesn't make sense. Okay, that's enough pontificating on my part. I think we're going to move on, Chance, if you don't mind.
But no, don't mind. That's okay.
You give really good commercials, so why don't you make the suggestion that people donate to this worthy cause?
Well, you should, because there's no other place in the whole world that's going to do more for you than this organization. And I am just so pleased to have been involved and to be involved with this organization for that very reason. There's a place for you to come. There's a place for people who are taking up the cause. There's litigation, as Catherine said, education, and there is legislation. And we can't do it. There's no way to really do it unless we have contributions from you. We need your donations. We need it to be able to move forward and help you. So by giving donations, by doing that, it helps us help you. You're helping yourself. Please support our efforts to advance this cause. Thank you.
And thank you, Chance. And folks, just so you know, all of our resources come from private donations. We've applied for grants, and guess what? We don't get them. Someday, maybe that'll change, but it hasn't changed in the last 12 years. So that's why we ask you for donations, and many people are donating, including on a regular basis. And we have donations from $5 to thousands of dollars, and we are thankful for each and every donation. I know there's one person in particular who lives in Los Angeles County, and you know what? He's not one of those people that makes like a monthly donation. Just from time to time, we get a donation of $5 from him. And I assume that's based upon his ability to donate. And you know what? He's made the largest number of donations of anybody to our organization, because whenever he has an extra $5, he hits the donate button on the website. And so that's all we're asking you to do. You know, maybe you can forego one latte or a martini a month, and you could make a monthly donation to the organization. These numbers really, really do add up. So thank you. All right, Rafael, you got another question or comment, sir? You need to unmute yourself, Rafael.
I was dealing with a company that works with pre-diabetic and diabetic people, and they have monthly meetings like this. And what they had on their website in order to enter to the Zoom meeting was a minimum donation requested or appreciated. I'm sorry, I lost you.
Yes, I unmuted
myself. Sorry if you heard my thread. I said that the organization that I was attending to for pre-diabetes, they had on their website, in order to enter to the Zoom meeting, they said in order to sign up, minimum donation appreciated.
But I'd be happy to bring it up to the board of directors. And folks, really, if you're not speaking, please mute yourself so we don't have what just happened. Somebody was muted, and so I muted that person. Maybe that's it. But no, we want this to be available for everybody. And so we've got it on the agenda for our next board meeting. We're going to talk about other ways to raise funds. And so I'll bring it up. I promise I'll bring it up, but it just makes me concerned that maybe there's somebody who can't even afford the $5 and they would think that they can't join us then. These meetings are free, folks, and they're recorded. In fact, so people who can't even join us on the Saturday morning or afternoon, depending on your time zone, can listen to it later. But I appreciate that input. Okay, so I'm not sure what's happening here, but something looks different and Chance is not present. So I'm just going to go ahead and move on, folks. This is a part of the meeting where we're really going to talk about California centric issues for people outside the state of California. We'd love to have you continue to join us here, but if you sign off, our feelings won't be hurt. So what we're going to talk about next is the tiered registry law. And folks, I hope you understand how invested AXSAL as an organization and me personally is in this issue. So AXSAL, we lobbied our state legislature for 7 years to try to get a tiered registry law. There you are, Chance. And we finally got it. But the fact is, we didn't get the kind of tiered registry law that we asked for. So we got a tiered registry law that was based on the offense for which you were convicted, your conviction. And we did not get a tiered registry law based upon your current risk. And sometimes it can make a huge difference. And so Frank Lindsay, as an example, was convicted more than 40 years ago, okay, in 1979. And he doesn't pose a current risk. But the fact is that he was put not on tier one, the lowest tier, but on tier two, the middle tier. At least he wasn't put on tier three, right? So finally, Frank Lindsay has gotten a tier assignment. I am his lawyer. I have filed his petition a second time. And I say that because when I tried to file his, when I did file his petition the first time, and this is in San Luis Obispo County, the court rejected the petition. And they said, nope, you don't have a tier assignment yet. So anyway, that's one of the problems with the tiered registry process. And oh, by the way, I'm very happy to report that we've filed a lawsuit basically asking the courts to immediately require our California Department of Justice to assign everybody to a tier. And that might sound mean, but it's not. It's basically holding them to account. So they had more than 4 years to assign everybody to a tier. We're talking about 100,000 people. I know that's a lot of people, but you know what? Chance and I can make a very educated guess about somebody's tier in about 10 minutes. Okay. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist, and it doesn't even take an attorney, quite frankly, to figure out somebody's tier. You look at the law, you look at the conviction offense, and where do they fit in? So we filed this lawsuit on January 5th. It was just served this past week, so about a week later, on the Department of Justice, and they're already complaining and whining about it. Oh, too bad as far as I'm concerned. Actually, I have no sympathy for them whatsoever. One of the things is, as a state agency, they got 60 new full-time employees. 60. And I don't know about you, but I could only imagine what I could do with 60 full-time employees, right? And they can't, in 4 years, get tier assignments for 100,000 people. Makes no sense to me. So that's why we filed the lawsuit. We don't have a formal response. I do have an informal response from one of the two top attorneys at the agency, and he was very defensive. And okay, you can be as defensive as you want. It's kind of like, I think he's not looking forward to what I call his judgment day. So by us filing this lawsuit, this issue is going to go in front of a court, and it's going to basically, a judge is going to determine whether or not the agency acts reasonably. And the answer is going to be yes or no. And I don't know what the answer is going to be, but I think just by the filing of the lawsuit, we're going to nudge this agency closer to getting their job done. And by the way, one of the things that's happened, it happened exactly a week after the lawsuit was filed. For the very first time, California Department of Justice has said, hey, if you have a question about what tier you're assigned to, or if you've been assigned to a tier, you can send an email to this email address, which they announced at the California Sex Offender Management Board meeting. They didn't send out a notice to anybody. They didn't do anything else other than make this offhand remark during the case on board meeting. But we put it on our website so people know you can too. Go, if you have an email address, and if you don't, contact Chance or contact me, and we'll ask, do you have a tier assignment? Because what the California Department of Justice did, number one, was they claimed that nobody could get, and they continue to claim that nobody can get heard by a court, except unless you've got Chance Arbustin as your attorney.
It's a special ruling.
Yes. Can't consider your tier assignment, I mean your petition, unless you have a tier assignment. And then, oh, by the way, we're going to slow roll the tier assignment. I mean, come on. This is like some Kafka-esque, you know, movie that we're watching or something. It's ridiculous. So no, we're not going to let these slime balls get away with it. And so I delighted in filing that lawsuit. I also delighted in the fact that, guess what? They actually assigned Frank Lindsay to a tier just prior to, actually it was the same day, come to think of it, the same day that we filed the lawsuit. We had to take Frank off of, he was going to be the named plaintiff in the lawsuit, but we had other plaintiffs as well. And so the good news is Frank got his tier assignment. He's assigned a tier two. I filed his new petition. Okay. But again, why should a state agency get away with shifting the burden of tier assignments from them to the individual registrant? Because this is how freaking ridiculous it is. California DOJ attorney told me personally, we do not have enough money to file to mail a letter to everybody on the registry. And you know what? That is utter nonsense. California is the fifth largest economy in the world. They are a state agency. And for them to say that they don't have enough money to send one letter to everybody on the registry is nonsense. And that's being kind. Okay. So we called them on it. And that's why we got this lawsuit. And by the way, by them shifting the burden, what somebody has to do, like Frank was contacting his registration office every single month asking, do I have a tier yet? Has my tier been assigned yet? I'm sure that his registration officer was hard hearing from him, but they deserved it, because California DOJ put him in that position. So anyway, that lawsuit is pending. If you have any questions about it, please ask. ask, please, in the chat room, tell me that you think it's a good idea. Just make me feel a little bit better on this Saturday. If you don't, well, okay, you're entitled to your opinion. But we think we did the right thing, Axol, by filing a lawsuit against the California Department of Justice. That is one of four lawsuits that have been filed challenging provisions in the tiered registry law. So remember, Catherine said education, legislation, and litigation. So this is part of the litigation arm. We have filed four lawsuits challenging different provisions within the tiered registry law. We're basically asking the courts to correct interpretations that California DOJ have made or their implementation of the tiered registry law. In addition to that, when you go to the legislative arm of the organization, what we're doing, we're going to the legislature and we're asking them to fix the law itself. And so things like, why is somebody who's been convicted of 288C, lewd or lascivious acts with somebody under the who's rather 14 or 15, why are they assigned to tier three while somebody with the same conduct involving somebody younger is assigned to tier two? That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. And if you look at the law from many different perspectives and facets, you'll find out, for example, when it comes to sentencing, somebody convicted of 288A gets a much harsher sentence than somebody convicted of 288C. Don't you think sentencing reflects dangerousness, right? So again, and we're not trying to put 288A offenders up on tier three. We're trying to move 288C offenders down to tier two. So that's one of our legislative requests. We're also asking the legislature to create an off-ramp so that people who are properly assigned to tier three, that they in fact have an opportunity to petition for removal. Right now, if you're assigned to tier three, that's it, over and out. You will never be able to petition for removal. And we know that's wrong. And we believe that people who are properly assigned to tier three, which is not everybody on tier three, that in fact, those people should in fact be given an opportunity to petition for removal. And when I made this point to the Sex Offender Management Board 2 days ago, I reminded them, just because you're eligible to file a petition does not mean the petition will be granted. Okay, so people need to remember that. It's not a get out of jail free card. It means a judge is going to consider the facts and circumstances related to you, your conviction, and what have you done subsequent to that conviction. Chance, anything you want to add there?
Well, yeah. I think that's a brilliant proposal. And it would make our system a true tiered system. And three, then it would allow a judge to assess risk. And that would cause the system then to shift to what it should be, which is a smart system on assessing these particular petitions. So I think this is a very good thing.
Well, in fact, Chance, it was your idea and it was a good idea. So it's good that you still support your idea. So that's another one. We've asked, for example, too, that people convicted of Penal Code Section 288.2, that the California DOJ recognize the fact that most of these people, if they were convicted of misdemeanor 288.2 or the felony that was reduced to misdemeanor, they're not even supposed to register according to the tiered registry law. But what do you know? The California Department of Justice is assigning these individuals to the highest tier, tier three. And so again, they're not eligible to petition for removal. These are some of the problems that were created with the tiered registry law. And, you know, not that we're perfect, but we could have created we did recommend a better tiered registry law than we have. And here are some facts to back me up. The fact is that right now, more than 50% of the folks have been assigned to tier three. More than 50%. If you add tiers one and two together, that's the rest of the pyramid. And what I've said is this pyramid is upside down. It needs to be the other way around. You know, in other words, tier three should be the smallest tier and tiers one and two should be much larger than tier three. That's my going in position. I reminded the Sex Offender Management Board on Thursday of what they said about number one, that they recommended a tiered registry as early as 2010. They wrote a whole report about it. It's not they said one day, you know, it'd be nice to have a tiered registry one day. No, they wrote a whole report about recommendations to the legislature, and they said, and we believe there should be a tiered registry in 2010. Guess what? It didn't happen. So in 2014, they wrote another report. And in the second report, they said, and it should have three tiers, and this is who should be on what tier. And again, the legislature, you know, ignored them mostly. And when they finally agreed to a tiered registry law. Another group of people who are being harmed by the current tiered registry law are people who are convicted of felony CP offenses. CP, I mean child pornography, though I prefer to call it unlawful image, okay? So people convicted of a felony CP offense right now in California, you're on the highest tier again. Does that make sense to you? Somebody convicted of an offense that's a non-contact, non-violent offense, and you're on the same tier as somebody who's committed multiple violent rapes? Doesn't make sense to me. And even, believe it or not, this is one time when the federal government and I agree. So the federal government under SORNA puts people convicted of possessing child pornography on the lowest tier, tier one. But that doesn't solve the problem in California. I know people get excited. Well, if only we were a SORNA state, then my problem would be solved. It's not true, because SORNA is the floor, and then the states can add more requirements to that, and they create the ceiling of the requirements. So Chance, I'm sure you have something to add to that.
Well, the rationale here for this whole thing is demand and supply. So, you know, in California, you know, the idea is if you cut off the demand for CP by making it so, you know, by putting it so high on the tier, and I'm talking about felony CP, that somehow this will stymie the supply, notwithstanding the whole rest of the world. It doesn't make any sense. And so, and a lot of the rationales for holding one thing up, just like this, you know, this other 288 point, whatever it was that Janice was talking about, even a misdemeanor, you know, what you don't have to register for it. And yet, you know, because they're parsing things up, not really respecting remedies in California or the fact that a misdemeanor is a misdemeanor is a misdemeanor, putting it in tier three, all these things have to be resolved one way or another. And so, you know, advancing these ideas is simply smart ways to remedy, you know, some of the flaws in this tiered system. It, you know, if they had adopted the original proposal as we saw it, you know, we wouldn't have these issues. But, you know, these were last minute machinations that were made to compromise, you know, it coming forth. And, you know, so we're stuck with its legacy, and we've really got to push for these fixes, or we're going to be in big trouble. Because, as you know, when legislators get a hold of something, they never get better. They always get worse. And so what you want to do is you want to cause a trend of fixing and smoothing this thing out, you know, to kind of beat them to their game. And this is what we're about to do in as far as our legislative push goes.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. I'd like to be specific about one of the pending lawsuits that has to do with a different provision in, well, actually, this is how California DOJ is interpreting the tiered registry law, but it can be fixed through legislation in that the legislature could clarify that attempted offenses are supposed to be, those convicted of an attempted offense, that is, are supposed to be assigned to tier one and not the tier for as if they had completed the offense. So maybe put another way, if somebody unzips somebody's zipper, maybe that's an attempted offense. Maybe that's what they've been convicted of, right? But then they admit, and it's an attempt, let's say it's an attempted rape. It's not a rape. It's an attempt, right? And there's a whole different penal code section, 664. So what's happening right now is California DOJ is assigning these people to tier three, not tier one, but tier three. And we believe that this also is very inconsistent with the law, case law, the statutes, everything. And in fact, we have, it's interesting, in some of these cases, most of these cases, what happens is that the government files a motion to dismiss the case or a demur, which is like a motion to dismiss the case, right? And trial court judges often grant those because they don't want to have to make what they think is a difficult decision. So they shrug their shoulders and go, we'll let an appellate court make that difficult decision. We're not going to make it. So when it comes to this case, though, that we filed about the attempted offenses, then it's interesting that the government did not file a motion to dismiss the case. And so we are actually going forward in the case. And in April, I'm looking at my notes here, on April 20th, I'll be in court arguing in support of a motion for summary judgment that we will be filing next week. We have cross motions for summary judgment. That means we're filing a motion for summary judgment. The government's filing a motion for summary judgment. And then we'll go argue it in April. And so I think this is the right way to do things. It really is bothersome to me, at least, that the trial court judges in so many of these cases are unwilling to make a difficult decision. And then we have to basically take it up on appeal. appeal. It costs a lot more money. It costs a lot more time to do it that way. We will do it. We're not afraid to appeal cases, but this to me is a much better way to do it. It's like, come on, let's armor up with our lawsuit, with our briefs and everything, and let's get in front of a judge and we'll both make our best argument and then let the judge decide. So I think that that is a really important case too. I know a lot of people who are very unjustly being assigned to tier three and therefore not allowed to petition for removal, again, because they were convicted of an attempted offense. Chance.
Incomplete offense is an incomplete offense. I mean, you know, if you look at the penal code, it's half. So technically, I know it's silly, but it should be tier 1.5. That's the easy way to look at it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, this makes perfect sense in terms of how it aligns up with California law. And I think that that's going to be a winner for us.
And folks, Chance mentioned it briefly, and I think I'm going to repeat and expand upon a statement he made about the tiered registry law that basically was signed into law by the governor is a result of a political compromise. So the tiered registry law was actually killed in 2017. It was on a Friday before Labor Day. I was just sitting in the room and watched the legislature do it. And, you know, I thought that was it. You know, this is gone forever. But quite frankly, and, you know, the governor of California did, in fact, contact the chair of that committee and said, wrong decision. You will revive this law and start this bill, rather. And so she did. But she said, you know, I'm going to change the law. And the governor, I guess, said, well, do what you have to do. And so it was changed. And that's why some of these mistakes were made. It was the political compromise. And again, the optimist in me says, oh, well, you know, if it's not based on fact, if it's, you know, that has no foundation whatsoever, it's just a political compromise, that we'll be able to overturn it someday. I quite frankly don't know if it's that day or not. We haven't filed any litigation yet, for example, on the CP offenses, because that is our weakest argument to make in a court. It's a good argument to make to the legislature, again, because people convicted of a nonviolent, non-contact offense don't belong on tier three. So we're trying to undo a political compromise. Unfortunately, the people who put the political compromise in there are still very active in the state capitol and are going to make it difficult for us to get this done. But we have to try, folks. We have to try it. We have to try it on lobby day. It's March 21. Please fly up that morning if you can, or even better, the night before. And then we will take this information to the state legislature, and hopefully they will do the right thing. But they're not going to do the right thing unless we show up. Chance, what would you like to add about that?
No, I think that is true. And I think that everybody listening to this should get involved with exactly what we're doing and help push this thing forward. You know, it doesn't take a village. It takes a freaking community. So jump on the train and let's get these things done.
And folks, I'm giving you plenty of notice. March 21 is the day. Come on, you can do it. There, as Chance just said, there's trains that come to Sacramento. There's planes that come to Sacramento. It's one day we're asking of your entire year of year. Please come join the group. The thing is, too, just to make sure you know, we will train you. We're not going to wind you up like a toy and send you into an office without any information and without training. You will be trained first. Okay. Chance and I will be doing the training, a few other people as well. So you will know what to do. You will be put on a team. Nobody's going in alone. Okay. You will be on a team. Hopefully every team will have a registrant, a family member of a registrant, and somebody like Chance or I, who's a supporter of registrants and family members. And so think about that. You know, you're going to be trained. You're going to be in a small group. We're going to have point papers for you to take with you. And your team is going to basically be able to figure out who is it that's like an expert on each point on the point paper. And then the other thing is, as I said, we're going to make sure that you get fed properly. And that's one way we can show our appreciation for you.
And one other thing I'll add here is, you know, a lot of you are living in isolation, separation, and you feel like you don't belong. But I'm going to tell you that Lobby Day is a great place to break that mode and to come and group together with people in common cause. Beyond all the benefits of doing that is going to be this solidarity that you're going to find in this movement, and the fun that people have in doing that kind of thing and having coffee together and eating together and in talking about things that, you know, you haven't talked about for years because there's no one to talk about it to. So I'm telling you, you're going to have a blast in doing all this, and you're going to find that getting outside and getting active is going to be good for your soul. So think about it. I bet you're going to come down and enjoy this thing. Just join it.
And I saw that David W. that you're on line here, and maybe if you don't mind speaking up at this point in time, if you're able to. He's one of our board members as well, and he's participated in Lobby Day several times, and I think that he could be a good spokesperson for this. My screen is a little wonky right now. Chance, do you see David's hand up by chance?
Let's see here if David's around. If he was, he'd probably speak up. I'm searching for him.
Yeah.
I do not see, I'm not seeing him.
Okay, I'm asking him to unmute. Let's see if that works or not. And we're calling on him.
Oh, yeah. David W., right?
Yeah. We're calling on him without any advance notice, folks. So I apologize to you, David. And again, I don't know if he's in a place where he can comment or not, but anyway, we can go on. I know that I've watched several people come to Sacramento who were very dubious, shall we say. Oh, there's Joe. He's got his hand up. All right. I'm going to call on Joe first, 916. I think you've already spoken once. So maybe Joe can share his experience with us. Joe.
Yes. I've been to Lobby Day 3 times now. And, you know, it's a wonderful experience. Not only do you get to meet other people and network with them and share information, but you're also legislative assistants who have the opportunity to change the law. As long as we show up and talk about the things that are important, they're going to listen. We've had opportunities where people said they didn't know that there was any opposition to a bill that was being presented. And when they found that out, with a very few number that showed up early on. So I would encourage to come on the 21st of March. Come the night before. There's a dinner that's being hosted. So free dinner, and contact Janice about more information. But please show up. Remember our motto, show up, stand up, and speak up. If we do that, the people that are in the position to change the laws will hear us. Thank you.
And thank you, Joe. I appreciate that you're sharing your personal experience. And I remember Joe in the very beginning. We didn't know him very well. And I think that really inspired Joe. I think it empowered him. I heard those words out of his very mouth. And what do you know, these days, Joe has become a board member. He was so inspired and got so active in the cause. Thank you, Joe. We really appreciate you. Okay, so I know there's some suggestions over in the chat room. I promise to read them. I don't think that we can get to all of the comments in the chat room right now. And I think, you know, if there aren't any other questions here about the tiered registry law, about our lobbying efforts, about our litigation, I think it's time to move on. But oh, here's a hand up, John. John, I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Just did. Good morning, and thank you for everything you guys are doing. One thing I'd like to throw in is, if there's anybody on this call that has gotten off the list, you guys need to show up too. We need to talk about how it's changed your life for the better, and also point out the things that you were prohibited from doing with these legislators. And I hope I'm not stepping on toes, Janice, but that's my thought. That's my suggestion.
No, I think it's a great suggestion, John, and I appreciate it. And we do have board members, by the way, who are former registrants, and either Chance was their attorney or I was their attorney, but they're no longer required to register, and they remain very active in the cause. But yeah, again, people who are listening right now, please, even if you're no longer on the registry, come and let your voice be heard, because you have something important to say. You do. All right, Chris, you've got your hand up. I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Yes. Hi, Janice. Regarding the tiered system, it was a little disheartening for me when I, after reading the proposed changes you Axalt provided to the CASOMB, it mentioned, quote unquote, the non-production felony CP offenders. So the kicker for me is, prior to the tiered system going into effect, I was on the short list of DOJ qualifications to be excluded from internet website notifications, but now I'm on it. And and what I read about your proposed only mentioning the non-production was a little saddening for me to read. It kind of lost the hope I'd had all this time to hopefully get a lower tier assignment.
So, Chris, were you when you're convicted of production, CP production?
Yes.
Well, I tell you what, since this is a recorded meeting, I'm going to suggest you go no further and you talk directly to Chance Oberstein or myself, okay, on the phone, and have a private meeting with us. So we're not throwing anybody under the bus, folks. I want you to know, if you're not on the list of the 7 proposed changes to the tiered registry law, it's not because we don't want to help you. It's because we have to do this incrementally. And I know some people in the whole 12 years of our existence, they've said, oh my gosh, you should light a fuse and get rid of the registry in one fell swoop. Nope, it's not going to happen. And somebody, mute yourself. Please mute yourself if you're not speaking. Thank you. Okay, so we have to do this incrementally. We plan to make other requests in the future. Okay, so this is, you know, we got, I don't know, say half a loaf of bread. We asked for an entire loaf of bread. Maybe we got half a loaf of bread. We're coming back to the legislature time after time to say we need more slices of that bread. Okay, we will get to you. I'm not offended if you remind me that we're not there yet. It's okay. And we are going to eventually get to everybody. So somebody with the last 3 digits of 669 on your phone number, I'm asking you to unmute yourself. You have your hand up.
Yeah, am I up?
Yes.
For just a brief, the last commenter, I would just be curious if my crime, and I'm not concerned with sharing it, is receipt of child pornography, which isn't even an option under the California registry, other than it falls under control of, I guess. But is receipt in your minds or in the filing possession, or is receipt part of production, as I understand the feds see it? The reason receipt is a higher crime than possession is because they assume if you received it, you're part of some sort of conspiracy, distributing, receiving, and it's easiest to catch people who when they receive it.
Okay, stop. We don't want to talk about every detail, okay? We're trying to protect you. So Chance, I think this might be something for you to address as a criminal defense attorney. My interpretation of what you just said, sir, is that that's non-production, but I don't know how it's viewed in the criminal defense world.
Well, the truth is that it's really individually viewed, and it depends on the facts and circumstances, and it's just an impossible question to answer. Your individual facts are necessary, so if you call either one of us, you can talk to us about it. If you want to contact me, just Google me. You'll find me. My number's out there, and I'll be more than happy to answer that question.
And we're serious about that, folks. Google Chance Oberstein, Google Janice Bellucci. You can find our contact information all over the web.
Pretty easy.
So looking at the chat here, somebody had a great question. It says, do we just need to contact you privately that we're going to participate in Lobby Day? No. In fact, I'd appreciate if you don't do it that way. We're going to add something about February 1 on the website. I'm asking people to sign up that way. Okay, so about February 1, that's about almost 2 months before. And so if you'll sign up that way, we would appreciate it so we can keep track of everybody. And the other one asking, anything else we should bring, like certificates? I'm not quite sure what certificates you're referring to, but regardless, the answer is no. I can't even think of one kind of certificate that would be relevant for Lobby Day. How about you, Chance?
Not offhand, no.
I mean, like if you have a certificate of rehabilitation, no, you don't need to bring that with you. You can talk to us and let us know you have a certificate of rehabilitation, but that's just fine. We've got to thank you here for all we do for the registrant population. Thank you, Yvonne. I see hand up again from 869. This is your third question, sir.
Yeah, this is 6869 again. As far as the certificate, this was kind of my original question was, technically I can't come to Lobby Day if I'm going to be associating with other sex offenders because I'm under supervision still. And one of my conditions is not to associate.
Okay.
It now would be good to pass that on.
Stop talking. Okay, for a minute, because okay. You made a really good point and I want to emphasize it. Okay. So he's absolutely right. By us inviting you to Lobby Day, please, if you're on supervision, whether it's parole or probation or in the feds supervised release, please, please, please don't violate violate those conditions. You must be aware of what your conditions are. And many people, unfortunately, on the registry who are on paper, that's kind of a slang term. If you're on paper and you can't be around other registrants, some people can't be around other felons, please don't come to Lobby Day. We don't want you to, we're not asking you to place yourself in danger at all. Okay. There's other ways you can support these proposed changes to the tiered registry law. For example, writing letters, and we will give you a model letter, a sample letter, making phone calls, and we will give you the phone numbers to call, or sending emails, and we will send you the email addresses. And we'll provide those on the website. Okay. So please, please don't come to Sacramento and lobby if you're on paper and have a condition that says you can't be around other registrants or around other felons. So sorry for the interruption, but I think it was really important to emphasize that point right away.
Well, a third option, I believe, I intend to, unless you say don't, ask my probation officer. I've got the best probation officer in California, I think. And I think he would give me permission to go. But
sure. Well, and that's great. If you have a positive,
I would need that.
If you have a positive rapport with your probation officer, your parole officer, you can always ask for, an extension, or, you know, just ask for permission to do that. Make sure you get in writing. Okay. So we want to make sure there's no ambiguity there, that you have proof that you asked for permission and that permission was granted. Okay.
Yeah, that's all.
All right. Thank you. And I'm really glad you made that point, because I hadn't discussed it. I hadn't mentioned it. All right. Okay. I don't see any more hands up right now. So why don't we go on to an issue that is important. And all of our issues are important, by the way, but here's another one we don't want to forget. And that has to do with people who are military retirees. And we're not even talking about military veterans. I'm a military veteran. I served in the U.S. Navy for 8 years, but the fact is I'm not a military retiree. So I wouldn't fall in this category, but we have people who basically, you know, served 20 plus years on active duty in the military and who were promised all kinds of things, including medical care for life, going to the, you know, exchange, going to the commissary, et cetera. And all of a sudden the federal government said, nope, we changed our mind. And to me, that is just awful. And I don't know, it's unconstitutional. I've made that legal argument once already in a lawsuit, but it wasn't successful. So if in fact you are a retiree, a military retiree, or if you actually are a veteran who was disabled, you also get some of the same or maybe even more benefits than somebody who's a military retiree. I mean, I think it's unconscionable that basically you were promised something, you give them the benefit of your 20 plus years on the as an active duty military person, and basically protected our nation. By the way, thank you for your service. The fact is that, you know, they should have to basically complete the contract here. They entered into a contract with you, and my God, they shouldn't be able to take the benefits away after you've already given them, you know, your 20 plus years of service. So we're investigating right now a possible appeal of the one case that we filed. This was, I think, one of those cases where the federal district court judge or the trial court judge thought, this issue is too hot for me to handle. I know what to do. I'm just going to grant the motion to dismiss that the government filed. So I think that it's possible that there's going to be a basis for appeal. I am considering filing another lawsuit or working with another attorney in another state to file a similar lawsuit. So, Jean, I see your hand up. Would you like to say something now, Jean?
Yeah, I'm... And can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm 80% service related disabled, and getting on military posts, I went many years ago. Before I went, I got my disability rating. Okay. And getting on post was horrific. But now that I actually have like an 80% rating, I mean, I can get on a non-secured base because we have one around my area, but okay. Getting on to a fully secured active duty base might be a challenge. challenge, I'm kind of hesitant, even though I qualify for the quote unquote benefits of going to the commissary and everything like that. Well, I might not. I can't remember if I do or not. But the thing is, I can get onto base technically, but the whole registrant issue is an issue.
Yeah, I understand that is an issue. And I have already worked on behalf of a couple of people here in California, as it turns out, in San Diego. One gentleman is a cancer survivor, and he was going to a Navy hospital in San Diego for treatment. And all of a sudden, they told him he couldn't get on base. And I will say, to the credit of that Naval hospital, they basically said, that's not right. And so we worked together to get that man on base. So he can go on base. He can go on base to get to the Naval hospital. He's not supposed to go anywhere else, but who knows, you know, after he gets on base what he really does. But the fact is, he needed that cancer treatment. I worked with another person, a registrant. Again, it was in the San Diego area. He had an RV and a boat that were parked legally parked on, I think it was a Marine Corps base. And basically, he was denied access to the base. And he's like, excuse me, but, you know, I need access to my boat and my RV. And so I was able to get him a one-time pass so that he could get his property off the Marine Corps base. So there are some workarounds, but I will tell you, there's an extreme amount of effort that's required to do this. Why is that? Because base commanders and their lawyers are really hesitant to do something that they think is inconsistent with this directive that they got from the Department of Defense. So that's where we are, folks. GN, if you want to contact me next week privately, I'd be happy to talk to you about your circumstances. Again, I am looking for at least one other plaintiff and see if we can't get this corrected. And in order to get in front of a different judge, quite frankly, maybe a judge who has the backbone, right? Maybe we'll get in front of Judge Bernal. He understands the situation. So, and Judge Bernal, in case you don't already know, he's the judge who issued this preliminary injunction last week. And by the way, I had appeared before Bernal twice before this, and I think that Bernal is a fair judge. So he, in my two cases, he ruled in my favor once and he ruled against me once. And you know what? I couldn't really dispute why he ruled against me the second time, even though, of course, I disagreed. But at least he was fair about it. And so when it came to, you know, when this PLF case, or SORNA regulations case, ended up before Bernal, I thought we're darn lucky that we got Bernal as our judge. He's one of the judges who's not afraid. He's a trial court judge who's not afraid to make a difficult decision. It boils down to that. Okay, so I think we're wrapping up this meeting, folks. I'm very, very grateful that you all are here. I realize I never even introduced myself. I hope you know my name, Janice Bellucci, and then I'm the executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. I'm also a civil attorney, so, oh boy. Yeah, so that's about it for me. I think that we have had some really positive news here as of late. I'm very encouraged by the courts. More of these courts are finding their backbone, not as many as I would like, of course. I'd like them all to, all these trial court judges to be braver. But you know what? I think we're getting more and more judges to start questioning the government and shifting the burden, which is a huge, huge deal, folks, in court. If Chance and I don't have to argue against, you know, the DA's office or the Department of Justice waving their arms around going, well, judge, you have to rule this way in order to protect public safety, then we have a much easier chance of success. So that's what I want to say to you. Again, Happy New Year to everybody. Look forward to seeing you in February. And Chance, do you have some closing words, sir?
Happy New Year. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next meeting.
Thank Excellent. You, Janice. Have a good one.
You're welcome, Mona. Take care, everybody.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you all so much. See you in March.
Thank you, Joe.